Since 1985, Stuart Peterson has offered strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops dynamic strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at stuart-peterson.com.
From the Land-Grant University in West Lafayette, Indiana, I'm Todd Gleason at Purdue University's Top Farmer Conference today. We'll talk in just a few moments about the commodity markets and the trade in Chicago with Mike Zuzulo. He's a global commodity analytics and consulting out of Atchison, Kansas. We'll take a look at land values and the prospects for the coming year with the director of the Center for Farmland Investment at the University of Illinois, Bruce Sherrick. He made a presentation at the Purdue Top Farmer Conference earlier today, and we'll talk with Jim Minter, too. He is the director of the Center for Commercial Agriculture and put together the Top Farmer Conference in Indiana. It'll all happen right here on this Friday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
The way the numbers finished up in Chicago, July corn up 14 and a quarter cents today at $3.49 and three quarters, September 3.55 up 13 and a quarter, and December corn finished 14 cents higher at $3.62 and a half, the March at 3.70 and a half up 13 and a quarter, July of next year at 3.80 and a half, 11 and three quarters higher, July soybeans at $10.89 and three quarters, 35 and a half cents the gain, the August at $10.83 and a quarter up 32 and three quarters, and November beans 33 higher. That's the new crop harvest month, $10.57 and three quarters. The settlement price, January's at $10.57 up 32 and a quarter, and next year's July at $10.27 and a quarter, 30 cents higher. Soybean oil up 54 cents, bean meal $8.70 higher. Soft red winter wheat in the July up 8 and three quarters at $4.20 and three quarters. The hard red harvest month at $4.05 and a quarter, 8 and three quarters higher. Live cattle futures 32 and a half cents higher at $112, 12 and a half cents for the August. October down 2.5 at 112.20. August feeder cattle at 143.25, 37.5 cents lower for the day. September at 142.75, down 57.5. And lean hogs 95 cents lower at $80.10. The energies in the crude oil up 7 cents a barrel at $45.20. Ethanol futures up 3 cents at $1.58.09. And the wholesale price of gasoline at $1.36.04, just about unchanged for the day. Dow Jones Industrial Average around 240 points higher. The U.S. dollar at 96.385 is up 0.002. Don't forget to stay with us if you can for Commodity Week. Our special guests this week include Dan Zwicker, Alan Brugler, Alan Dearden, and Greg Ginder. That's Commodity Week on willag.org. WILLAG.org.
Support for agricultural programs comes from AgriGold, celebrating their 13th year as a major corporate underwriter of Illinois Public Media's ag programming and e-newsletter. AgriGold's support allows their customers and growers everywhere to receive quality ag information at no charge. More information on AgriGold can be found at AgriGold.com.
This is Jim Angel, state climatologist for the Illinois State Water Survey at the University of Illinois Prairie Research Institute. July has been cool and wet so far. The statewide average temperature was 70.8 degrees. That's 4.3 degrees below normal. The statewide rainfall is at 2.6 inches, which is about three times the normal for early July. Areas in the northern half of the state have received 1 to 2 inches of rain. Meanwhile, the southern half of the state has been seeing widespread amounts of 2 to 4 inches, and the southeastern corner has been getting 5 to 8 inches. As a result, a lot of the concerns with dryness in western and southern Illinois have been washed away. However, there are a few areas, especially around Peoria, that are still behind on rainfall. According to the National Weather Service, temperatures will remain on the cool side this weekend with highs in the upper 70s and low 80s in the north and in the low to mid 80s in the south. Next week will be warmer with highs moving up into the upper 80s and low 90s throughout the week. Dew point temperatures are expected to remain high, climbing into the low 70s after Tuesday. That means more stress on humans and livestock during the day and less of a chance of cooling down at night. There are chances of rain from Tuesday onward. Expect rainfall amounts to be in the order of a half an inch or so in most locations, but most of the major storms will pass to the north and south of Illinois this week. The forecast for all the way out to July 21st has us in a pattern of being both warmer and wetter than normal. This is state climatologist Jim Angel.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Illinois, for 100 years offering financial products and services specifically for the agricultural industry, including farm real estate and operating loans, crop insurance, and point-of-sale financing, as well as farm cash management solutions.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason, coming to you from the Purdue Top Farmer Conference. Before we get to Mike Zuzalo, I want to talk to you just a little bit. For those of you who listen to the home radio station in the morning, you'll have noted, and I know you have because you've already called, that Drew Lerner is missing since July the 1st. His contract ended June 30th. I have 25 analysts on the air. They all volunteer, including Drew, in this program on Wednesday afternoons. However, that program part was a paid position. We filled a gap at one point in our programming content. It just didn't seem right to me, so you can blame me. The decision is on my part. And Drew and I have talked about this a couple of times. He was having some difficulties making sure that it all was there just because of the time constraints. But frankly, if you want to give me a call, I'd be glad to talk to you about it. It just seemed like the right thing to do. I've got 25 analysts that are on the air every week, and that one slot really didn't fit our ethos here, the fact that this is a volunteer-driven service. So our thanks to Drew for understanding, and my thanks to you as well. Now, Mike Zuzalo is here. Hey, Mike, thank you, too, for volunteering all your time with us. Go through what happened in Chicago. Nice little bounce today.
Yeah, and I think it was a stretch to fill the gaps that we started and made after the free fall and the post-4th of July holiday trade. I think what essentially happened, and this probably segues us into Tuesday's report very nicely, I think the trade refocused from a U.S. supply increase based upon acres and rainfall adding to the yield to world crop supply demand, Todd. And I believe that because I think the change in the trade mindset, especially in wheat and corn this week, was focused mainly on the CONAB numbers cutting so severely the Brazilian corn crop production number, and which ends up being about 330 million bushels from what USDA gave us in June. And I also say that because of the European wheat and feed grain numbers that came to us this week as well. You know, France and Germany are the two number one producers, and both those countries look like they're going to get hurt in feed grain wheat production. So I think that along with this super typhoon that's coming in on Saturday into central China, and it's an already very saturated central China crop belt. These three things refocus the trade's attention. The gaps that we started out with at the beginning of the week, we started to climb back towards in the new crop corn and beans. So if I'm right about that and the dollar remains contained, crude oil remains underpinned, and that's where the soybeans come into play. If the global numbers on Tuesday's report don't go up as much, and the U.S., even with the U.S. numbers going up, I think that's going to be the key, because we may end up seeing a report now where the U.S. share of export demand increases dramatically, potentially in some cases. We may see a bigger crop here in the United States, but we may actually be positioned to take over a much greater market share. So I think it was a U.S. to global transition this week. I'm hoping that we can get away from the La Nina-driven supply bull and really look at a demand bull market from here on out.
This would be a very distinct move in the marketplace when we go in July and look away from the United States crop to the U.S. crop. And we'll know very quickly, I suppose, once those WASDE figures are released on Tuesday, or the World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimate Report at 11 o'clock. What do you think they will show for sure?
Well, I do think that the trade is, and the analysts' estimates that do their own analyzing would back this up. I think the trade is already well over 170 in yield for national corn because those crop conditions have not fallen the last 3 weeks. We're still at 75% good to excellent. We're still at 2014 levels in good to excellent corn conditions, and we've just had rain and we keep seeing a lot of heat. So I think the trade has priced in a 172 plus yield at this stage of the game. That's probably the dividing line for the U.S. numbers becoming more important than the global numbers. And what I mean by that is if the yield goes above 172, 172 and a half, and all of a sudden we're talking about a 2.3 or bigger carryover here in the United States, then maybe the U.S. numbers start to take more precedent. I say that because that 330, 340 million bushel cut in Brazilian beans would be more than offset if we did get a yield bigger than 172.5 with the new acres. It ends up being about 340 million bushels. U.S. increase, 340 million bushels. Brazil decrease if we stick around 172 yield with those new acres.
All right. So if that happens on Tuesday, meaning we shift to the global picture and we truly shift, have we seen bottoms in the corn and the soybean market?
Well, you and I talked about this last Friday. I think we got to get there in wheat first, but I won the weekend copy that I'm going to be doing for producers. And if anybody wants a free subscription, I'll be happy to give that to them, especially in light of what you talked about with the weather. Be happy to do anything, you know, we can for the Will Radio to make things smooth in terms of this transition with the weather. But the first time I've seen France wheat prices and U.S. wheat prices at the Gulf go to even has been right here, right now. And we're at the lowest prices since 2010 when it comes to French and U.S. soft red wheat, and both of them are trading about 178 a ton. That is an extremely good sign. It makes us competitive. So now we have to worry about, I think, unless USDA gives us some massive surprise, is the Brexit effects, is the stronger dollar effects, and that competitiveness in our market share. I think it's going to be about market share, and it's going to be about currencies, and it's going to be about demand from here on out if USDA doesn't give us any great big surprises.
Hey, thanks so much, Mike, for taking the time and volunteering with us.
My pleasure, Todd. Just send me a note on globalanalytics.biz and reference Will Radio if you want a free copy of this weekend's newsletter.
Great. Mike Zuzulo is with Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting. He's out of Atchison, Kansas. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason, coming to you today from the Top Farmer Conference at Purdue's campus, actually their Center for Food and Agricultural Business, the Beck Center, just to the west of the West Lafayette campus in Indiana, along today with Bruce Sherrick, who's a professor and agricultural economist at the University of Illinois. Talk to them a little bit, actually more than a little bit, about land values and capitalization and the center that he heads there on the Urbana campus from TIA CREP. Tell me a little bit about capitalization in farmland values as we made our way through the run-up of commodity prices and land values. Did producers spend all the money that they could when they purchased land at that time?
No, I think that's a great sort of launch point. If you think about farmland values as simply being an estimate of future income capitalized back into today or discounted back into today, a common way of looking at farmland values is to take some amount of income you think they can produce, discount it by what you think your cost of controlling that asset would be, and you come up with an asset value. So if you look through time, in the 80s, we had what people can now identify as sort of a fundamental divergence. The land values got far above the income simply couldn't support that through a capitalization argument. When we went through the early 2000s and land values were going up fairly rapidly, incomes were going up proportionally even more. So if one applied that on a fairly routine, blind, one-year-at-a-time basis, it would actually look like farmers underpaid. So if you simply, again, capitalized income, took all the income you made and divided it by what your cost of controlling the asset would be on a percentage basis, you got numbers that would have been higher than transacted values. But this is a little bit like confusing weather with climate. People didn't expect incomes to stay at the level they were at, or they thought the long-term prospects were being sort of rationally increasing, and so land values went up and interest rates were going down, so land values went up, but in a much more controlled fashion. It didn't just simply say, well, this must be permanent because we had higher income this year and all future incomes will be like this. Farmers and investors and others rationally said, we had really good some outcome, like we may have had really good weather or really bad weather. We don't completely readjust our views of climate. We had really good incomes for a while. We didn't think those would be completely permanent.
So by comparison, if you look at the late 1970s, mid-1980s, a run-up which was out of the norm and the capitalization was pushed by an outside force in to some respect, that would have been the banking system,
that said, yes, go ahead and borrow. And then a real crash after the fact. I take it that's not something you would be looking forward to at this point, because the capitalization in the beginning happened in a different way.
Right. I think there are lots of fundamental differences between the 80s and now, and people who simply are looking at the technicals will point out there are some similarities, but there are also a lot of differences. In the 80s, we had, as you indicated, kind of a sector-based question. It was very much farmland alone. And we had a run-up which was, as you indicated, in a sense fueled on the lender side by being able to borrow 80% LTVs at 15% nominal interest rates and so on. And that was a very unsustainable kind of situation. Today, some of the things that differ are we have a crop insurance program that's fundamentally different, and it puts a different kind of floor underneath possible incomes. We have a more rational sort of credit spread in mortgage markets. So instead of a very thin spread over treasuries, we're now actually paying for credit risk in mortgages in a much more rational way. So lenders are much more sensible. We also have very low interest rates compared to the 80s. So a change in rates doesn't necessarily put people out of business because you can't service just the debt payments alone. There are other truly fundamental differences, though, in the world markets as well, and where we think where we think commodity prices could and should go. And most importantly to me, this time it's not a farm sector only experiment we're doing with interest rates. It's very much an economy-wide question. Cap rates are very low on all real assets. We have a yield curve that's completely different than it looked prior to the housing crisis. And it's a great deal of excess liquidity at the short end of the yield curve. And all of that argument for farmland applies to all the other assets you might be investing in as well. So, for example, if we have a very bad monetary experiment, kind of monetary policy experiment gone bad when we try to reverse what happened, that's a economy-wide question, not just a farmland-only question. So in a relative sense, I don't think you get the kind of bubble effects in one sector relative to others.
Finally, and since you mentioned economy-wide, I'd like to talk just a second about interest rates. Many are thinking that the Federal Reserve at some point, and have been for quite some time, will begin to raise interest rates. That would put some inflation into the marketplace. Producers, those interested in commodity prices, are wondering what that impact would be, obviously thinking that prices would inflate along with that. Do you see interest rates moving up anytime soon?
So for quite a while, we've kind of empirically looked at the yield curve and said it's a complicated thing to raise interest rates. The Fed has expressed very directly an interest in doing so when the economy gets, in a sense, healthy enough, inflation could be tolerated, unemployment gets low enough, and productivity increases come back. But it's a hard thing to move, and it's a hard thing to move anything but the shortest-term interest rate, and that has not had quite the same effect in the rest of the yield curve as it did historically. So December of last year, when interest rates were just marginally moved, we had kind of an equity market response in January of almost minus 10%. And it sort of signaled back to the Fed that there were some feedback signals that made it pretty complicated to move this in a quick way. So I think the Fed has provided appropriate guidance that they'd like to increase rates, but the cautionary kind of implementation is that they don't kind of get ahead of themselves right now. I don't see that there are signals absent kind of surprises in productivity gain and surprises in employment that relax those pressures. So it's hard to see that rates can move very quickly in the short term. On a world basis, it's also hard to find evidence that there's difficulties with the value of the dollar in moving the interest rates up much as well. So I think it's just a very tough thing to actually implement at this point, and I don't see a rapid change.
Thanks so much, Bruce.
Thank you.
Bruce Sherrick is an agricultural economist at the University of Illinois. Let's continue now our conversations from the Purdue Top Farmer Conference in West Lafayette, Indiana, at the actual Bex Agricultural Center, their agronomy farm here. Jim Mintert is with us. He's the director of the Center for Commercial Agriculture and helped to organize this event. I've been coming on and off for about 25 years. How old is the Top Farmer event? Do you know?
We're approaching 50 years. I think this is the 49th annual Top Farmer, and so we're looking forward to 50 next summer. It's been a great program over a long period of time, and the program has evolved over time as farmers' needs have changed over time. In recent years, we've made it more of a management orientation, so it's really focused on helping commercial-scale farmers identify ways that they could make some improvements in their operation, and we do it through a variety of different kinds of presentations, and this morning was more of a workshop presentation focused on a case study of an individual farming operation actually based out in the Pacific Northwest, but had some innovation aspects that people could bring home and start thinking about their own operation a little bit differently.
How do you define commercial scale for the purposes of Top Farmer?
Well, from the Center for Commercial Ag's perspective, we define commercial agriculture as people who are engaged in agricultural production as a means of providing a primary source or a majority of their income. And that's a fairly broad definition. It obviously allows us to work and be engaged with people that already have relatively large-scale operations, but it also allows us to work with people that have aspirations of moving into that. So if you think about beginning farmers or farmers that are very earlier in their career and want to ultimately derive a majority of their income from production agriculture, we do a lot of work with them. We do a lot of actually beginning farmer type workshops with people that have aspirations of moving into that category later in their careers.
A couple of months ago, Purdue, the Center for Agriculture, Commercial Agriculture here, along with the CME Group, introduced an ag barometer, different topic, of course, but it comes out once a month, just a couple of days ago. It kind of measures what the subjective feel, I think, of the farm economy is in the United States. What did the last set show us?
So the Ag Barometer is kind of a sentiment index, as you indicated, and we do survey 400 farmers around the nation every month to get a feel for what their perspective is with respect to the ag economy. And the last 3 months really have showed a little bit of an improvement in the barometer. We started collecting data for the barometer last fall, and the sentiment in late fall and through the winter was actually declining pretty significantly. We think that was driven by declines in commodity prices. We think it was also driven by a farmer's realization in the winter that their financial position was deteriorating. When we saw the rebound start to take place in corn and soybean prices in early spring and continuing into June, we saw an improvement in the value of the index. So it improved in April. It improved again in June. We had a little bit of a drop-off in the month of May. April, May, and June stronger than it was during that winter and early spring time frame. Now that we've seen a downturn, especially in corn prices, it's going to be interesting to see what the next edition of the barometer, which will come out the first Tuesday of August, shows us.
Jim, thanks so much for taking time with me today, and it's a really great conference here.
Thanks a bunch for coming over, and we're looking forward to having more people from your listening audience join us next summer.
Jim Mentert is the director of the Center for Commercial Agriculture here on the Purdue University campus outside of West Lafayette, Indiana. I'm Todd Gleason. Back in a couple of minutes, we'll take a look at the agricultural weather forecast.
This stock and commodity report is made possible with support of the Friends of WILL and Bates Commodities in Normal. Bates Commodities can be reached at 1-800-383-4647 or on the internet at batescom.net.
It's National Milk Chocolate with Almonds Day. On this day in agricultural history in 1497, Vasco da Gama left Lisbon with four ships to search for a sea route to India. He was the first European to sail there, and he opened the area to Portuguese trade and colonization. In 1810, Gabriel Gustav Valentin was born. This German-Swiss physiologist was the first to discover the digestive activity of pancreatic juice. In 1831, John Pemberton was born. Pemberton was the pharmacist who invented Coca-Cola in 1885. By the way, at first it was a tonic called French wine cola. He later modified the formula, taking out the alcohol and adding vegetable essences. Originally, the syrup was meant to cure headaches. In 1881, the ice cream sundae was invented. Edward Berner of Two Rivers, Wisconsin, put chocolate syrup over a dish of ice cream and served it to a patron at his drugstore. Why chocolate syrup? Because flavored soda water was not allowed to be served on the Sabbath. Thus, the new treat, the Ice Cream Sundae, named after the day of the week it was created. And in 1886, it rained snails in Cornwall, England. By the way, July is one of the most prolific months of the year for raining all sorts of living creatures. The top animals likely to fall from the sky? Fish or frogs? And that's this day in agricultural history.
I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. This is the closing market report for Friday afternoon. I'm out of the office, traveling today at the Purdue Top Farmer Conference at their Beck's Agricultural Center. That's their agronomy farm just to the west of the main campus in West Lafayette, Indiana. We're now joined by Eric Snodgrass from Agrible. He's just to the south of the U of I campus in Urbana-Champaign. Eric, thanks for being with us. Tell me about the weather that we've had the past week. It's, I suppose, has been really good for the growing crops.
So Todd, the last week's weather has really helped a lot of the corn and bean crop that had been dry for some time. As we discussed last Friday, big rains were moving through Kansas, Missouri, and southern half of Illinois. And unlike the scattered storms we had in the weeks before, these rains were steady and widespread and dropped a lot of precipitation. With soil moisture high again, the temperatures dropped off last weekend and stayed cool for a large section of the corn belt for several days. For crops that were planted earlier in the season, the cooler weather was well-timed. Now, outside of the United States, major flooding in parts of China seemed to have impacted the soybean meal demand due to its large impact on hogs there. Then, Australia weather has been very favorable for crops, and the Indian monsoon has come in with better rains than we've seen in several years. Basically, when you add it all up, our grain markets have really taken a hit. So I guess the question is, what does the forecast hold as we kind of head into the middle part of July? Well, right now, a shortwave trough is pushing along the U.S.-Canada border near Lake Superior. This trough has kept the northern corn belt wet in Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Michigan, where multiple rounds of storms have passed through. Now, Michigan really needs this rain badly, too, as they were dry for nearly all of June after a late plant due to too much rain earlier in the season. So, closer to Champaign, multiple rounds of storms have the crop around here looking fantastic. The cooler weather sticks around for the weekend before we build back into the middle and upper 80s for next week. Now, the jet stream is very active and transient and has resisted blocking patterns this season, which can be detrimental to the crop. So the consequence of this transient pattern to the jet stream is that the heat waves we've been getting, well, they don't last too long, and they've been followed by storms. Well, nothing is slowing this pattern down anytime in the near future. In fact, another deep trough exits the Rockies into the northern plains around July 11th. Ahead of this, warm, humid, and unstable air does move into the Corn Belt and increases our chances for severe weather again for next week. But beyond this, the GFS is showing the development of yet another ridge centered on the Central Plains for the July 18th kind of time period, and it's supposed to stick around maybe until the last week of July. If this materializes the way that the models are currently forecasting, this could introduce some serious heat to the Midwest. So we got to be on the lookout for that heat stress again for those crops that were planted much later in the season due to early season rains. But looking really long term, August is looking to be much warmer than average. Multiple models have shown this consistently, so we need to be on the lookout for late season heat stress, especially from the warm overnight temperatures. But when you look at the grand scheme of things, overall, we're going to get through the first part of July without much major heat stress for the corn crop. As we've been talking about for quite some time now, the precipitation patterns have really picked up, and as a result, we're not seeing a lot of water stress either. So when you kind of put it all together and boil it all down, we're looking at a pretty decent crop that may have some later season stresses on it, but right now, things are looking pretty good.
Thanks, Eric. Eric Snodgrass, of course, is with Agrible, joins us on the closing market report from Illinois Public Media. Stay with us if you can. For Commodity Week, our panelists this week put on a great show last night, up on the website in its entirety at willag.org, W-I-L-L-A-G.org.